It's time to start.
We'll call the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record note that it is March 24th, 2011, and it is 1 o'clock. Today we'll be taking testimony and discussing Senate File 898 and the Delete All Amendment, which is the Transportation Omnibus Finance Bill. And I think we'll get started with the testimony right away as we wait for a quorum to come to the committee hearing. On the docket for public testimony on the A1 Delete All Amendment, we have first up is Todd Olson, and I think what we'll do is have three of you come up at one time. We have Todd Olson with Metro Cities. We have Dane Smith with Growth and Justice, and Helen Durista. And before we get started with the testimony, we would like to ask that you keep your comments precise. We will attempt to allow you 3 minutes to testify. And for those of you that are coming later, and I think there's about 19 testifiers that want to just make some comments, if your comments are the same as somebody before you, maybe you would want to just say that you agree with a previous speaker and give us details of how your situation might be different than others and how this bill may impact you personally. So we'll begin with Mr. Olson. Mr. Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Todd Olson. I'm with Metro Cities, and I will be as brief as possible, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of issues I want to talk to in the bill. Metro Cities is an organization. We represent cities in the seven-county metropolitan area. And one of our policies says the Twin Cities metropolitan area needs a multimodal regional transit system that serves both commuters and the transit dependent. So based on that, we are opposed to the depth of the cuts to Metro Transit and the general fund. We think they go too steep. It makes it too reliant on MVEST, which, as was pointed out on Tuesday, has struggled to reach its forecast. It's come in low 9 out of the last 10 years. And just makes it hard to rely on that forecast for that money. A couple of other issues. We do like the idea behind the economic development from the Trunk Highway Fund. Just a couple of issues on that. Economic development doesn't always fall along trunk highways. When you use trunk highway dollars, it does limit to can only spend it on trunk highways. We like the idea. And we know based on the budget, this is a way to get some money into it, but we would like to look for ways to free some of that money up to deal with economic development in places other than on trunk highways. And also the local match. When we did some money for interchanges 2 years ago, I believe the match was 50% that MnDOT set up. We'd like to just let people be aware that we'd like to talk about setting that match. It's not dealt with in the bill, but we would like to have that considered as we move forward. And sticking with economic development, the transfer of the livable communities dollars, this was an idea that came about 2 years ago to help solve a transit deficit then. We opposed it for a number of reasons then. One, we feel it's a bad policy. It's levied by the Met Council. This dilutes the transparency of that levy. And also, we thought it was a bad precedent. Times were slow then for development. It was difficult for the Met Council to expend all its funds, but the economy is turning around. There is development out there. They had $7.5 million available from the LCDA funds. They expanded over $7.3 for 2011. And they had seven other projects that were available but weren't quite ready to get the granting that they're still in the process at the Met Council. So we think this is a bad idea to transfer those funds. It's gap financing for economic development. Getting projects moving at the city level is difficult. Times are tight for getting credit for projects. There's a lot of pre-development projects that have been approved, and we think this would be a bad timing in the light of the economy to move that funds from projects to transit funding.
Well, thank you for your testimony. And just to clarify, the livable communities portion in the bill is strictly an option for the Met Council.
It is an option, and the Met Council did a great job in 2009 of avoiding transferring it. They promised it to be the last dollars in, and they lived up to that, and they never transferred a dime. They didn't spend any of it. But I think with gas prices going up and the as far as the cuts have gone, I think it'd be difficult for them to avoid using it this time.
Good. Well, and thank you for your testimony again. And as far as the trunk highway appropriation, the $100 million to economic development, we are constitutionally constrained. I believe
you probably understand
that. So thank you, Mr. Olson. And now we'll move on to Dane Smith. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dane Smith, President of Growth and Justice. We're a policy research organization that really focuses on the smartest possible public investments that expand prosperity, that are good for both job growth and for economic fairness. We, too, are here to speak for minimizing to the extent possible, to every extent possible, the proposed cuts to transit. We really do value evidence-based research to assess what we should do with our public sector investments, and we have identified clear benefits from transit on a number of important fronts. The two most important are jobs and congestion. It's that simple. Transit, on the jobs front, transit links low-income Minnesotans to jobs. Transportation is a major barrier to employment for low-income Minnesotans, and better transit simply reduces those barriers. Minnesotans with household incomes below the poverty level are three times more likely than Minnesotans above the poverty line to take transit to work. Their employment advances the economic well-being not only of those workers, it reduces state costs at the same time their valuable work contributes to our overall economy. And cuts in transit funding and the resulting cuts to transit service would adversely affect the ability of low-income Minnesotans not only to get to work, but to build better lives for themselves and their families. On congestion, we simply want to make the point that drawing from our research and from research by many other groups, transit in the Twin Cities helps alleviate traffic congestion. This is an important transportation challenge. Congestion is a real economic problem for Minnesota. It adversely affects not just people and convenience, detracts from time at work, time at home. The business community agrees with this. It affects freight movement, workers on the road, reduces the public's return on investment from highways because it cuts the volume of traffic that our roadways can handle. In effect, transit increases the capacity of major metropolitan thoroughfares and in this way relieves congestion on the highway system. I would ask you to consider this, that buses in a recent year was during the peak morning travel hour were carrying what otherwise would have been two more full lanes of auto traffic down Interstate 35W at Lake Street and into downtown Minneapolis. Reductions in transit funding could push more commuters into their cars. Computers, too, I guess, and onto the freeways, exacerbating our congestion problems. These two issues, access to jobs and traffic congestion mitigation, stand out as clear examples of how transit benefits individuals. So we urge you to avoid cuts if at all possible. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Now we have Helen, is it Durista?
Durista.
Durista. Welcome to the committee. And if you'd identify yourself, I appreciate it.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Helen Durista. I'm not a professional lobbyist. Just a minute. Transit. We all got here today. Today, unlike on Monday when I took the bus from the suburbs, I drove because I can. I also wanted to bring my friends along with me to see how our great state operates in government. My friends contribute mightily to our nation and our state. Working two jobs each and raising these young children, Mrs. Chemikong and her husband, as well as their older young adult children, ride the bus to work, to school, and to their friends' homes. Without these bus trips made by this capable family, our food would not be stocked on the shelves of our local groceries. Our sick and elders would not have trained and certified nursing care. Our furnaces and air conditioners would not be serviced. Our citizens and group homes would not be lovingly tended. Our high school football team would not have an excellent defensive linebacker. and the taxes we collect from this vital family in the state of Minnesota would not be collected. But we and many others who are not here today because they're at work or at school need to continue getting on our buses at the times needed to arrive at school, work, or home. For working families, and here I refer to families with even tighter budget constraints than our great state faces, do not have more money, truly. It isn't a matter of not grabbing that designer coffee today or when going to that just-released movie to skip that bucket of popcorn to have another $62 a month to toss in your fare box. It's a matter of being able to pay the rent or the mortgage. It's a matter of purchasing medicine or having a pair of gloves on your hands today. Keep funding whole for us. Keep lines running as they are. In fact, schedule more, and more growth and parity of income will result. Thank you for allowing us to testify today.
Thank you for coming in, being a part of this hearing. We appreciate it very much. Next up, and I will note that we do have a quorum present. We have Natalie Tungsvik and Emma Wright with the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall?
Now that we have a quorum here, I think it would be appropriate to move. I move to adopt the A1 delete all amendment to Senate File 898.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Senator Hall has moved that we adopt the A1 amendment to Senate File 898. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you for coming, and welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, please. Okay,
thank you. My name is Natalie Tungsvik, and I'm a junior at Hamline University and the vice chair of MPIRG. So hello, everyone, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having us today. MPIRG is a statewide, student-directed nonprofit that is present on 8 campuses in Minnesota. MPIRG represents students all over the state, and these cuts are concerning to all of our members. College students use the bus to get from home to school to work to go out with friends to get their groceries and everywhere in between. Many college students rely on public transit and without it would have a much harder time getting to where they need to be. In some cases, it would be impossible. Even small schools like Hamline have campuses at different locations, and off-campus internships are common graduation requirements. College is in no longer just one location. With the rising cost of tuition, gas, and car payments are not feasible for many students. MPIRG believes that all people in Minnesota should have choices with regards to transportation. The proposed cuts would severely limit those choices. Decreased service availability and lines for transit are all real outcomes of this budget decrease. We think it is important to take long-term views of the problems that we are facing today. A well-working public transit system is part of this solution. Transit systems bring with them economic development and provide an affordable way for people to get to work, particularly in these tough economic times. This service is vital. Public transit is an integral investment in our state and communities. Great cities have well-working public transit systems, and ours is already small. To cut transit funding would be doing a great disservice to the people of this state. Please keep our transit system whole. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Emma Wright. I am a sophomore at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and a member of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. I grew up in Apple Valley, Minnesota, just south of here, and now live in Minneapolis. And similar to many graduate and undergraduate students attending school in the Twin Cities, I live off campus in the Southeast Como neighborhood, just north of the Minneapolis campus. This semester, I have classes on all three campuses. This means I'm a 5 to 10 minute bus to East Bank, a 10 minute bus to West Bank, and about a 30 minute bus and walk combo to St. Paul campus. I work off campus, 10 minute bus ride away, and I'm a mile and a half from the nearest grocery store, which is about a 10 minute bike or bus and walk combo as well. I also have a night class on East Bank. And thankfully, there's a Metro Transit bus that I can take, about a five-minute walk from my class, that I can take home at 8 o'clock at night when it is dark and I am walking alone. I do not have a car, but what I do have is a job. I have 19 credits at the university, volunteering, and when I have time, I like to think that I still have somewhat of a social life. This means I operate on a very tight schedule, and the only way I'm able to get around on time is this Metro Transit system. It is a vital part of my life, the lives of my roommates, the lives of my friends, and the many other students in the Twin Cities. But these cuts will do more than affect the students living in the city. This summer, I had just moved home out of the dorms back to Apple Valley, but I had the opportunity to keep my job in Minneapolis. I did not have a car, but I was able to have a job this summer because of the Metro Transit system. Every day, I would bike to Palomino Park and ride, load my bike on the express bus, and make my way to downtown Minneapolis. Now, sometimes these buses were full, and I'd have to wait to the next one, but thankfully, there were enough that I was able to make it. The times that this bus were available were limited. You kind of had to plan out your whole day beforehand, but it made it was relatively convenient and affordable, and it made my employment possible. For me, it was vital for my employment, but for others, these suburban buses are the only means of transportation to school, whether it is the U, MCAD, MCTC, or one of the smaller private schools in the area. The cuts to transit may make a small dent in the budget deficit, but that small change will be deeply felt by those reliant on the system. By making these cuts, you are cutting access to groceries, you are cutting a way to get to school, you are cutting a way home to get, are cutting a way to get home at night, to go to work, to access the businesses trying to survive in this economic recession. By making these cuts, you are cutting the chance of me being able to have the time to testify at the Capitol again. The negative externalities of these cuts may be difficult to translate into a dollar amount, but you can see that it will cause a significant hardship in my life and the lives of the thousands of riders. On behalf of myself and countless other transit riders who would be impacted by these cuts, we urge you to keep this transit system whole.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Now we have up Dave Van Houten and Kathleen Murphy with the Transit for Livable Communities. David and Kathleen. Very good. We will rearrange the order and possibly pick them up at 5 o'clock when we come back and meet again. Catherine Wagoner, Resource Employment Action Center. Why don't we have Ethan Fowley and Joanne Backer also come up to the testifying table at the same time? Welcome to the committee, if you'd...
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Murphy. I'm here on behalf of Transit for Livable Communities, which goal is to create a better balanced transit system that works for all people. And I also believe that that same goal is part of my life, that we need a better balanced transit system for everyone, so everyone can get to their jobs, and those that do not have jobs at the present time can get jobs where the transit system can create those things for people. I found out in 2004 that I was not going to be able to go back to work because of my health was taking a toll on me. With the help of my doctors and going through intensive therapy and dealing with my disabilities, I now realize what transportation means for me and what public transit means for me as a disability person and for all other disability people who do not work. I went on Social Security disability in 2006. I was no longer depending on people to take me places where I needed to go. I was able to get back on public transportation, and I was able to be more independent And that was a good thing for me, and it gave me a better quality of life, which I hope that we can continue to have with people like myself who are disabled. I do not drive, so there is no option for me to consider when I am choosing my transportation. The bad thing about all of this is that once I went on Social Security disability, my income dropped tremendously. And now that we see that there are budget cuts coming at us right and left, I am wondering how much more will the government take from my income that I need to have for my support for my transportation with Metro Transit. And I also see that these budget cuts can also lead to less transportation for people in rural areas who are disabled and depend on their local county systems, and that could get cut totally. And this will severely hurt not myself, but other disabled riders on fixed incomes. Cutting back on funding and to increase fare hikes is not a good thing. And I look at my budget today as something as, what can I do about it? Because Social Security will give you what they give you, and you have no choice but to accept that and deal with it. And years ago, all of my adult life, when I was working, I was able to have extra money for the things that I needed and to get around. And now, with my disability, it has limited me to doing what I have to do. And for other disabled people, we have no options and choices. And so I say to you today, please look at these considerations and be really concerned about what it does for the people of low income. Thank you.
Thank you.
What's up, man? Good afternoon. I'm Catherine Wagoner from Employment Action Center, Division of Resource. I work with people who have recently lost their jobs or are severely underemployed and have turned to public assistance in order to have their families survive. I'd like to address the part of this bill that states that Metro Transit must impose fare increases at $10 million per year or $20 million over the biennium. The Met Council has translated a $20 million fare increase into a 50-cent increase in an individual fare. I don't know, it doesn't seem like much. 50 cents is not a whole lot that you have in your pocket. But at a very minimum, an individual in my program makes about 14 bus trips a week if they go one place every day. That costs them about $25 a week. And that's if not if it's during rush hour. If it's during rush hour, of course, it's more. With an increase of 50 cents per ride, it would be $32 per week. That's about a $30 a month increase, and a typical family on assistance receives $437 a month. They are already paying $108 for transportation for themselves, even more if they have children over six. A 50-cent increase makes the transportation go from one quarter of their monthly budget to one third. Many of us worry about fitting a 75-cent gas price hike into our own budgets. We lament that a tank of gas costs us $15 more than it did last year. So in that context, $15 is a lot of money, as is 75 cents. It's the same for people in my program. $30 a month is a lot of money. So is 50 cents. 50 cents is a lot of money. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Just to be clear about the provisions in the bill, that these are options that we set for the Met Council.
Yeah, I understand.
As ways of dealing with this reduction in funding. And there are a lot of options within the fare increase options, including monthly passes and deals that they have with universities and with businesses, along with a general increase in fare box fares. So if they're loading up 50 or 75 cents on any particular group of individuals. That isn't what was intended by this legislation, and that I would hope that the Met Council would be more creative and thoughtful in how they address these spending reductions than to do something like that to you or your group. So thank you for your testimony. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks.
Yeah? Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your comments. And I'll take them as an invitation to work a little bit more, perhaps, as we move down the path. Because the way I read the bill, this $10 million per year fare increase is the second tier, the first tier being operational efficiencies, which are arguably not available to Metro Transit in the numbers that the cut reflects, $16 million per year. I mean, we just can't squeeze $60 million out of Metro Transit in light of scheduled route service as well as the dial-a-ride, et cetera, in light of the cuts that we've already served up to them in recent years, and in light of the fact that it's already identified as one of the most efficient transit providers in the country. So it's not going to be long before they get to that mandated $10 million per year fare increase. And that's telling me it's got to come from somewhere and someone in terms of fares. And, of course, there's all kinds of different, employer-based programs and student-based programs and the veterans ride free, et cetera. But it's going to come out of working people in some way, shape, or form. So I appreciate your comments. I'm just saying the language as written now is pretty straightforward.
Well, I appreciate your comments too, Senator Dibble, and I would look forward to working with you, and maybe we should have a provision in here to, if they go to the extent that they have to increase fares, that maybe they should report back to us and show us how much they're going to cover of the spending reductions and where they're going to accomplish that, just for the pure purpose that we can stand between them and some of the people that they may try to put an excess burden on. I'd very much like to work with you on that.
I have some ideas. You might hear about them later. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
I'm sure I will. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Yeah?
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Joanne Backer, and I am here with Transit for Livable Communities. And I would like to build on some of the comments that were recently made, both at a personal level and also on behalf of others. First of all, on a personal level, I am currently unemployed, and I am living on less than half of the income that I used to enjoy, relatively speaking. I can drive, but there's no way I could afford to have a vehicle. I'm voluntarily using public transportation I had before when I had my entire income, and I really benefited greatly from it. It was my car. It still is my car. If the budget cuts are such that services decrease and a fare increase would ensue, I would be hard put to deal with some of these things. People talk about making cuts and giving up the designer coffee and the first-run movies. Well, those are ancient history in my case. I make all my coffee at home, and maybe I get to go to the Riverview where the admission is $3 when I go to the movies. So on a personal level, decreases in transportation and fare increases would greatly impact my way of living. Even if there's a fare increase, that means the bus cart would also increase. And that is how I do it with the bus cart. On a second level, I would like to reinforce what this lady, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name, has said about the impact of a fare increase on low-income families. Before I retired, I was an AMFIP worker. Minnesota Family Investment Program. And what happens oftentimes when a person, the whole point of the program is to support employment. AMFIP does a pretty good job of that while a person is on assistance, receiving the grant. But when they get their jobs and they start transitioning off is when reality hits, and it hits them hard. They will earn enough money to get off the grant. Their income is a lot better than it was before, but it isn't oftentimes enough to carry all of the burdens that they suddenly find themselves having to pay. Oftentimes, when a person goes off of assistance, their rent goes up. If they're on this rent subsidy, their rent goes up. So they have to face increasing rent. They are probably losing a lot of the other little things like the bus cards they may have had while looking for work. And a dollar a day to go to work, extra a day to go to work, adds up. And oftentimes I have seen the phenomenon where people are so overwhelmed by this going, leaving the grant. I mean, they still have the medical, they still have the food, but they don't have the grant, their rent goes up, and a lot of times they just give up. It's not worth it. They quit their jobs. Now, what good is that? How does that support work? So I really would advise against any kind of fare increases and putting that on the burden, adding that little burden to all those folks, because they really work hard to try to get a job and to try to keep that job. But sometimes even a little, that would be the straw that would break the camel's back. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Up now is Anna White. Mike. Lee. Tracy Farr.
Chair, this is actually Ethan Folly with Fresh Energy.
Okay, we're one step ahead. Okay, we'll have Tracy Farr come up in just a little bit, and Ethan, we'll have you start us off.
I'm Tracy. It's a girl's name, I understand.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Ethan Folly with Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nonpartisan, research-based nonprofit that's working to help Minnesota transition to a clean, efficient, and fair energy system, including reducing our reliance on oil. This is an economic imperative, as I'll remind you today. I don't think I need to remind anybody that gas prices are etching up to $3.50 a gallon here in Minnesota. And what that means is every 1 cent increase in gas prices takes about $30 million out of Minnesota's economy. That's money that's not staying to support local businesses. It's not and to help grow our economy. It's going predominantly to Alberta and then countries in the Middle East that don't really like us very much. It's imperative that we reduce that dependence on oil. This bill, as proposed, sends us in the wrong direction towards that. Quite simply, by cutting transit, we are making it harder for people to get away from high gas prices by finding affordable transit options. And this isn't just the people that impact the people that can no longer choose to take transit. It also impacts all of us on the road. As has been brought up, congestion, there are huge congestion relief savings from transit. The Texas Transportation Institute estimates these savings last year at $80 million in the Twin Cities alone. And so when we raise fares, and this bill would lead to a fare increase because there's really no alternative other than that. The Metropolitan Council has done an amazing job of squeezing the maximum efficiencies out of the transit system already. The legislative auditor's report on transit in the Twin Cities said that Metro Transit has the second most efficient transit service of any peer region and is almost twice as efficient as Dallas-Fort Worth region. So we've squeezed all the efficiencies out over the last couple of years when budgets have been cut. And I also point out that the fares have increased 75% since 2000. Imagine the impact that has on many people. It's also then the discouragement for new people to try transit. So that means that people who are on the edge might consider transit are now in traffic, leading to more congestion for other folks, leading to more use of oil furthering our dependence on oil and taking more and more of our hard-earned money here in Minnesota and sending it to places abroad. So I encourage you to take a step back, look at some of these creative and innovative solutions that have already been discussed about here today, and delay action today. Work harder to find solutions that don't lead to transit cuts or fare increases for our economy and for our people. Thanks.
Thank you. Ma'am, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ann White, and I've been working for the last 5 years with a coalition of neighborhood planning organizations along Central Corridor called the District Council's Collaborative. And our concern has been that the needs of the people along the line be considered in planning for the Central Corridor. I'm here today to ask you to reconsider the provisions in the proposed amendment to Senate File 898 that would drastically impact the availability of transit in the future. Specifically, I want to address the proposed $32 million reduction in funding for buses and the mandated requirement that fare increases of $10 million a year should be imposed to cover operating expenses for buses if the shortfall cannot be closed with operating efficiencies. I think you've heard a very articulate testimony from others about the impact on low-income people of fare increases or reductions in transit service, and so I will not speak to that specifically. However, I would point out that while people like me, and I suspect most of you, have other options than transit, there are many who do not, and they need transit to get to jobs, schools, grocery stores, and other necessities of life. I hope the committee will also take into consideration the fact that any fare increases or service cuts would trigger the need for a Title VI service and fare equity analysis to determine whether the impacts of the changes would have a discriminatory impact based on race, color, or national origin. And I suspect that would be the case. In a recent March 8th Dear Colleague letter from FTA Administrator Peter Rogoff, he emphasized the importance of this requirement, stating that, and underlined, compliance with Title VI is especially important when launching service or fare changes that may be necessitated by financial difficulties. That would seem to be the case here. Now to the question of the amendment's mandate that local transit agencies close the gap with first operating efficiencies, then the $10 million a year in fare increases. I strongly feel that these are decisions that should be left to the local transit agencies, not mandated by the legislature. In the Twin Cities, Metro Transit planners do an excellent job of reaching out to transit riders and considering their priorities before proposing solutions to close a funding shortfall. In fact, we're already beginning to talk with Metro Transit about how to prepare community members to participate in a sector study in 2012 to determine the best allocation of resources for transit operations. Finally, I want to close with a short story related to my personal interest in retaining and expanding a robust transit system in the Twin Cities. My father will be 99 on April 24th. He's now in a retirement home, but for many years he lived in a small town with no public transportation. As a result, he continued driving until he was 93 because he had no other way to get around. And I can tell you, in those last years, the Neighbors cleared the road when they saw him coming, perched on a pillow to see over the steering wheel, or through the steering wheel, rather. So my question to you is, do you really want me to be driving in the Twin Cities in 20 years when I'm 93? I certainly don't. So I strongly urge you to make every effort to at least retain the current level of transit in these tough economic times, and to leave decisions about how to allocate transit resources to the local transit agencies in consultation with their transit-dependent constituents. In return, I'll promise to throw away the car keys when I reach a certain age.
Thank you very much. Mr. Farr.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've come as a local businessman.
Please identify yourself for the
record. As a father. I am Tracy Farr from Now Bikes and Fitness. I come here as a business guy and as a father. This reduction in transit will have an impact on my business as a small local employer. I can't afford to pay the highest wages in town. So most of my employees ride a bicycle to get to work, or on those hellacious days Minnesota is fond of, they will then use public transportation to get to work on time. Also, looking forward to the coming season, more and more people are choosing to use cycling as a part of their transportation options. And it only works if it's paired with the other modes of transportation. So being able to ride a bike to the bus stop, get on a bus, and get where they need to go. So it's very common to hear discussion in our state and throughout the country about how families make intelligent choices on limited funding and what they can do. This transportation is one of those choices. Public transportation saves an individual, depending on which study, between $5,000 and $8,000 a year, as opposed to operating a vehicle, operating a car. So as families are making those choices, to deny them the public service that good government provides is a slap in the face. The second part of my testimony involves my daughter, who's got a dream. So she barely made it out of high school, completely frustrated and uninterested in high school, but for one teacher who somehow made sure she got enough credits to get out. Now she's a second-year student at Augsburg and is crazy about school. And she has been invited to attend to study at Oxford for a year. But that's a significant increase in her financial obligation. So my kid, she's moving back into my house this summer to save money so she can reach her dream. If she has no public transportation option available to her, that is just not going to be possible. If she can't rely on reliable public transit, she cannot save the money necessary to achieve this dream of hers. So it's personal, it's selfish, but it's a powerful story for me. Neither of my children drive, which I never would have foreseen. They choose not to because they have to use their funds for other living expenses. Thank you for considering our testimony.
Thank you for giving it. Next up, we have Mike. Is it Jude? From St. Paul. Mike. Lashella Sims, Joe Hoff. We'll try Mike Madden. Ms. Sims, I think we'll start with you, and if you would identify yourself for the record.
Greetings. I'm LaShella Sims, and I'm down here listed as being with MICA. MICA is an 80-plus congregation, interfaith congregation of various denominations and organizations around the state. I also come before you as a citizen and as also as a woman vet, being a member of a women's veterans group. I myself did not serve, but I have family members who did serve. My father, three brothers, and my son just recently finished his four-year term in the military. Right now he's a student at the U of M getting a second degree, and he takes the bus everywhere. But in starting off, I like to say that that as I was here Monday night, and I was in one of the sessions on transportation, and I watched yesterday on television, and I had some concerns as I listened to the polite back-and-forth passive-aggressive statements, which eventually led to an era of the us-versus-them attitude, the outstate versus in-state, the rural versus urban. And that's greatly disturbing because we all live in Minnesota, and our tax dollars are supposed to support everyone, no matter where they live. MICA advocates affordable housing for all without exception. As I listened, I thought about the persons with disabilities all over the state, seniors all over the state, workers all over the state going back and forth to work, and college students all over the state as they get around on transportation. And as a veteran, as I go around speaking for veterans and support our veterans, I continue to ask people in different forums, and I always bring to attention that our veterans are treated invisibly for various reasons. And then as I ask them as they're making the plans, how are your plans incorporating them as they reintegrate back into society? And they are coming back even as we speak. The wars are winding down. They're coming back in various states of health. And we're glad to have them back, but we also want them to be reintegrated. They're our sons and daughters. They deserve no less. They need to get around on public transportation to get to the VA for the various medical needs, hunt for jobs, go to college as my son is. He takes the bus everywhere and wouldn't have it any other way. He chooses not to drive. He goes to his classes. And as I said, we don't treat as our sons and daughters, as they've been away and as they come back, we call them heroes, which they are. We don't treat heroes up substandardly. We advocate for them. And while they've been away, when they come back, we want them back. We want them to participate in all aspects of our society. And remember, in closing, it helps us to define that transportation is not a nice thing to do. Really, it's a way of defining who will survive and how they will survive. Transportation is not a nice thing to do. It's a means of survival. And I've lived through two bus strikes, and I've walked to work, which took me 2.5 hours each way. And I wouldn't want that again for anybody, no matter where they live. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. First, I'll have a little bit of correction. My name is Joe Foss. That's F as in Frank, O-S-S.
Thank you
very much. As in Sam. But thank you for allowing me the time. So I grew up and currently live in Moundsview. I'm a transit user and a teacher. I'm here to testify against any dramatic cuts to the transit system. Since Moundsview is 13 miles north of downtown Minneapolis, and then even a little bit further from downtown St. Paul, my community has limited bus service, yet I'm still committed to using the bus when I can. I may bike or drive my car partway to Central Avenue or the bus hub at Northtown in Blaine, then take the bus the rest of the way. The limited service in second-ring suburbs forces one to have a car with all of its associated costs. such as when I had to pay over $1,000 for some car repairs last year. I serve on the Environmental Committee at St. Joan of Arc Church in Minneapolis. We've had a major focus on encouraging people to bike, carpool, or bus to church. We need reliable and affordable bus service in order to, as this echoes some of Ethan's testimony, to lessen our dependence on oil, decrease money going to authoritarian governments in North Africa and the Middle East, reduce greenhouse gas emissions and carbon pollution, and create a cleaner, more livable metro area. In closing, a well-funded transit system also helps motorists by reducing traffic on the road and lowering the price of gas at the pump. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Haas. Appreciate it. Mr. Madden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm kind of a novice at this, but it seemed a little weird at the beginning when public testimony was interrupted for an amendment to be moved and passed while most of the chairs were still empty in the room. As I said, my name is Mike Madden. I don't own a car by choice. I live at 1768 Eaglehart Avenue in St. Paul. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace Local Chapter 27. I'm here to ask that funding for transit be maintained at current levels or increased because mass transit is a more efficient way to move people than single-occupant vehicles and has the potential to greatly reduce our dependence on oil and thus protect the environment. I'm not here to speak to those who deny global warming. They're beyond reach. They reside in ideological la-la land where science is not a discipline but rather a tool of propaganda. When science conflicts with their worldview, they deny it or resort to fake science. Neither am I here to speak to those who maintain that our budget woes are entirely due to government spending and that further cuts are the only way to a balanced budget. They refuse to acknowledge the imbalance and unfairness in our current tax system. The wealthiest in our country now pay less in taxes as a percentage of their income than do working class people. The notion that increased taxes on the wealthy will somehow stifle job creation is unfounded. It is not the nature of capitalism to create jobs. It is the nature of capitalism to create profits. Capitalism will just as readily eliminate jobs in pursuit of short-term profits as it will create them. If you want to stimulate job growth and aid the economic recovery, start taxing capital gains and other investment income at rates higher than a working person's labor. You will simultaneously find yourself with more revenue for human needs, including transit. There's a great deal of funding for transit to be found in the bloated Pentagon budget. Conservatively estimated at $800 billion per year, our current military deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan do not serve the purpose of defending America. They do not protect us from terrorism. They exacerbate the problem because the tens of thousands of innocent civilians we are killing creates more terrorists than we can kill. So cut the Pentagon budget by two-thirds. Divide the $500 billion saved among the 50 states, and that's $10 billion for Minnesota. The budget deficit is erased with money left over for human needs, including transit. As for transit in my part of town, I look forward with great anticipation to the opening of Central Corridor LRT in 2014. The environmental impact statement for the project calls for the creation of four new north-south bus routes on Fairview, Hamlin, Lexington, and Victoria. These new routes are important to the success of the corridor as they intersect University Avenue at station areas. Please begin planning now for their funding and implementation. In short, Minnesota is not broke. America is not broke. The threats facing America are vastly overstated, and military aggression only makes them worse. Let's return to a fair and progressive tax code free of loopholes. Let's end the wars now and enjoy the peace dividend. Fund human needs, including transit. By funding transit, you will create jobs. Jobs for bus drivers, train conductors, mechanics, and office workers. Bring our troops home today and make those jobs available to them.
Thank you, Mr. Madden. Appreciate your comments and your views. I do want to correct one thing, though. I did announce that there was a quorum present before the amendment was taken, which is a part of the procedure here, and it was done appropriately. But thank you very much for your comments.
I'll take your word for that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I was just going to also make that statement that in case anyone was thinking something untoward did occur, it did not. We were simply putting the language of the bill in front of us. It's a procedural matter, and there was a quorum present. We didn't take a substantive vote outside of debate.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Now we have Mr. Jacobs, Mr. Howd, and Mr. Burtness. Jacobs, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I am testifying as an individual who uses public transit.
For the record, and
my name is James Jacobs. I live here in St. Paul in the McAllister Groveland neighborhood.
Thank you.
I'm 73 years old and semi-retired, and I use public transit to get to various parts of my remaining work, which means taking the bus to Minneapolis or taking the bus and using my bicycle to get to appointments that I have. I'm a retired, semi-retired family therapist and social worker, and I work for an adoption agency. I visit young families who are adopting children and determine their suitability for adoption. And I use public transportation whenever I can to make those appointments. I encourage you to not mandate any fare increases in public transportation for public transportation users, although it's probably something that I could afford. I know a lot of people that I see on the Metro Transit lines where that would be a real challenge. It also would be a challenge to my my grandchildren and my children who use public transportation. I have a 16-year-old granddaughter and a 12-year-old granddaughter who use public transportation to get to events outside of school and to get home from after-school activities. The 16-year-old also has a job, part-time job, that she uses public transportation to use. And any kind of fare increase will be challenging to them. When I ride the bus, I see a lot of transit users being parents of young children who are using the transportation system to get their children to appointments and to go and buy groceries and things like that. And any kind of fare increase is going to severely affect people like this. So I encourage you to explore all options in looking at the transportation needs for the community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Howd.
Yes, my name is David Howd. I live in the Twin Cities metropolitan area in the fine city of Roseville. And I'm a retired architect, and I frequently use the bus system to travel from my home in Roseville to the Nicollet Medical Center, and because I'm a senior, I have the benefit of reduced fare in off-peak hours. So I ride with many of the people during the day who have talked so eloquently about, so I don't think I needed to add that much of that because it's been very well stated. Other than the fact that I'm very impressed by watching people count out their nickels and dimes to put in the little fare box that they've obviously planned ahead to do to get on that ride, on that bus ride. So the other issue I wanted to talk about has been touched on a little bit about here, but that is something that I'm concerned about for my children and my grandchildren, is that by riding public transportation wherever it's possible and practical instead of driving a vehicle, I am taking one individual action to address our country's dependence and addiction to oil. Every day in the Twin Cities and across the states, thousands of people drive alone in cars to and from the same destination. This dependence on oil across all developed and developing nations is causing an increasing global security crisis. This has forced the United States to be connected to unfriendly petrol states that we eventually may, and currently are, coming into military intervention with. Now, however, the gasoline that we use in the Twin Cities comes mostly from the friendly state of Alberta, Canada, where it's excavated from open pit mines in a form of a very thick bitumen encased in sand, and that turning this into heavy oil to be able to pump to a pipeline in Minnesota creates huge toxic waste ponds, and the pollution caused by the extraction of oil from tar sands is a serious source to the harm of the people, to the health of the people of the once pristine environment of the friendly state of Canada. So all the new oil and gasoline reserves we seem to have come at a huge price and a much greater expense to get out of the ground. So there's little we can do about our dependence to foreign oil. Little we can do about our dependence on oil, period. But if as many people as possible utilize mass transit, this can help decrease our demand for oil, and supply and demand, it hopefully can reduce the cost of gasoline. So to recap, what other people have said, cutting funding for operating mass transportation will put an immediate hardship on a significant number of our population that's already hurting. And in the long run, cutting funding for the development of mass transit will eliminate one of our only feasible ways of reducing our dependence on oil. Thank you, Chairman and Committee.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Burtness.
Mr. Chairman, committee, members of the committee, my name is George Burtness. I work in the special ed department for the St. Paul school system. I work in a transition program which serves 18 to 21-year-old youth with disabilities. We spend most of our day in the community going to and from work using the transit system. Most of the students that we work with in our school will never get their driver's license. They'll always be dependent on the public transportation to get around. Increasing fares will decrease the ability of these folks to be able to get out and become part of their community. I realize there's a big budget deficit, but rather than increase fares, you can raise my taxes. In the words of Mr. Red Green, we're all in this together, but I'm pulling for you. Thanks.
Thank you for that. And we are all in this together, and appreciate you that you're pulling for us also. I understand now that MnDOT has some comments that they would like to make on the bill. And then I think after that we are going to start with amendments, and if the committee would oblige Senator Lilly, we'll have an amendment right away. There are testifiers from the aviation industry that need to get back to work, and I would appreciate if we could start with that one. Unless there is objection. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Mike Schottauer. I'm the director of the Office of Transit for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Commissioner Tom Sorrell asked me to express his support of transit as an important part of the total transportation system, both for the metro area and greater Minnesota. It's the position of MnDOT that a robust transit system is vital to providing access and mobility to transit-dependent citizens and enhancing quality of life for all Minnesotans. The general fund is an important, stable source of approximately 32% of the total state and federal funds that will be granted to greater Minnesota transit systems from 2010 to 2013. Senate File 898A1 proposes to reduce that general fund for greater Minnesota transit from the current base level of $16.292 million by $4 million per year. Reduction of the general fund for greater Minnesota would have a compound effect of reducing local matching funds. The local matching funds to state and federal dollars come primarily from the transit fare box and currently total about 27% of all greater Minnesota transit spending for operating costs. So if the general fund is reduced $4 million and the local share remains at that 27%, investments in greater Minnesota would be reduced by about $5.3 million or 8%. Currently, transit agencies in greater Minnesota provide about 1,030,000 hours of bus service per year. So the outcome of this bill would be to reduce that by about 81,000 hours of service. and that's equivalent to completely eliminating the transit systems in East Grand Forks, Granite Falls, Hibbing, Morris, and Rochester. It's a big hit. In addition to the loss of mobility for thousands of Minnesotans, making it more difficult for them to get to work, school, church, shopping, and medical services, this would also have an impact of reducing jobs by about 50 in these transit agencies. Specifically within the bill, we'd like to talk about lines 3.21 through 3.29, which prevent reduction of the amount granted for assistance to the elderly and disabled transit systems and limits reductions to rural transit to 10% below 2011 levels. As a result of this, cuts would largely be concentrated in urban areas of greater Minnesota, and we would propose in MnDOT, rather than having that prescriptive language, that MnDOT continues to use its current rigorous method of evaluating transit assistance applications, which takes into account design service, or service designs, excuse me, performance, accessibility, and many other factors. It's been noted that Greater Minnesota Transit would have about the same amount of overall state funding, and that is the Motor Vehicle Sales Tax Plus General Fund, to work with in the 2012-2013 biennium as was available in the 2010-2011 biennium, even after this $4.0 million per year general fund cut. But it's important to note that even if we keep the money the same, the service has to drop just because of the impacts of inflation, and increased fuel costs will even make it worse. In addition, that assumption that the funding remains the same from the current biennium to the next biennium is making the assumption that the motor vehicle sales tax comes in according to the current forecasts. And I'd just like to note that we had a pretty tough experience with the most recent forecasts, where the 2010 forecast for motor vehicle sales tax for the 2011 state fiscal year suggested that Greater Minnesota Transit would receive about $25.5 million. The most recent forecast has that down to $19.6 million, almost a $6 million reduction. So we're already taking a hit this year, and that could happen again in the future, especially with world events having some tough effects on the economy. I'd just like to note some goals that are in statutes for Minnesota and MnDOT in transportation. One is to provide transit service to all counties in the state to meet the needs of transit users, and currently 10 of Minnesota's counties do not have countywide service. Another goal is to increase the use of transit as a percentage of all trips statewide by giving the highest priority to the transportation modes with the greatest people moving capacity and lowest long-term economic and environmental cost. Reduction of the general fund revenues for Greater Minnesota Transit will push Minnesota farther from achieving those goals. So in conclusion, MnDOT supports Governor Dayton's budget proposal to keep the general fund appropriation for Greater Minnesota Transit at the base level of $16.292 million per year. And we would request your consideration to delete lines 3.21 to 3.29 of the amendment so that the decisions for the cuts are left to our rigorous process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schadauer. I have a report. It's called the 2010 Transit Report, Financial Statistics. And I was just wondering if this was this created by MnDOT?
Chair, yes, it was.
It shows the percentage of local match, and that I picked up on your discussion about the size of the local match averaging for the rural. Did you say the rural systems?
Mr. Chair, the average is about 27% statewide.
I see numbers in here as low as 15%, 19%. I see very few that even are at 30% local match. I just did you take the time then to average this out and to ensure that your percentages are probably correct?
Mr. Chair, I think if you look through there to the statewide aggregate totals, you'll find that it is 27%. And you're certainly right that a lot of them are down at the 15% level, but those tend to be for the smaller rural systems. And I think you'll find that for the larger urban systems, it tends to be a higher percentage, and that really pushes the balance higher.
Okay. I thought I had heard that you say that the rural, which we consider the small rural transit systems and the ones that we are, if you will, protecting at the 10% level, we're at 28%. So you are including then the urbans and the rural? I understand, Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, my quoting of that 27% was for all Greater Minnesota transit systems, including rural, small urban, urban, and elderly and disabled.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mr. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schadauer, you mentioned putting our ability to match federal dollars perhaps at some risk. Can you describe more what how many dollars potentially we could be risking?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I didn't mean to imply that federal dollars were at risk. We have to have a match for federal dollars, but we're fortunate in Minnesota not to be at a level where those dollars would be at risk. What I meant to be, the point I meant to be making about the matching was that local dollars must match the state and federal dollars. And anytime we take away some of those state or federal dollars, local dollars go away as well. So the hit is greater than just the state dollars that go away.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I move the A-16 amendment.
Senator Lilly moves the A-16 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, while this is being handed out, what we're talking about is aircraft registration fees. And there are three basic ways that we collect funds from airline industry and from airplane owners. They are the airline property tax, the aircraft fuel tax, and the aircraft registration fee. And there has been some inequilibrium in how we have collected those, and this bill or this amendment tries to rectify some of those. The aircraft registration fee was set about 50 years ago and was based on the value of an aircraft. Those registering a plane in Minnesota pay about 1% of the value of that plane to register in Minnesota. And as the values have increased of these planes, this fee has become quite burdensome on Minnesota businesses and out of line with our neighboring states and with the rest of the country. To give you an example, when a business registers a plane in Minnesota valued at about $20 million, the fee is about $200,000 a year to register that plane. In Iowa, that same business would pay about $5,000. The fee does increase over a period of time, but even in 10 years, you would still be paying $50,000 to register that plane in Minnesota. This issue has come late in the session, we know that, but we have been able to work out an agreement with those that have the planes, the companies that have the planes, with the airline industry, and we have had conversations with the department also, and they have had input into this process. This amendment would shift the registration fee from being based on the value of the plane to being based on the weight of that plane. The larger the plane, the larger the registration fee. So to maintain that balance, there is an increase in the jet fuel tax from 5 cents to 10 cents to offset the differences in those fees. This fuel tax does not impact the airlines. They are structured a little bit differently, so Delta and other valued companies in the state are not impacted by this. And it also does not impact private owners or smaller planes that would be impacted also. So basically what we're doing is we're paying less in registration fees and more in fuelage taxes in order to maintain some equilibrium in the costs or the revenues from this area.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Senator Lilly's work in this area. It's one that has been important to me on the Transportation Committee and dealing with aviation and the Department of Aeronautics, and I hope that we can support it. And I would just point out that this is the airports fund is a dedicated fund. This is not general fund dollars. These are paid by members of the industry into a fund that then the primary purpose of which is to maintain at airports across Minnesota safety. That's number one.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I think this is a good amendment. I support it too, but I was wondering, Mr. Chair, we haven't heard this in the committee yet, which is fine, but I was wondering if just for the record, we might hear for just 30 seconds or 10 seconds from the principal who kind of negotiated this, just to say, just to kind of bless it on the record and say this is all good.
We have testifiers here, and that's okay. We took the amendment first to Senator Dibble. John Kroll and Neil Bracken. Senator Reiner.
Mr. Chair, I just want to reinforce Senator Dibble's point. I know I got a call from my airport manager this morning that said, you've got a bill coming up in transportation that deals with this issue, which those of us who've served on transportation before know very well. And I said, don't worry about it. We're doing the omnibus transportation bill. And so now I know what he was worried about. And I think it's more just people didn't know it was coming and don't know exactly what's been worked out. So, I mean, conceptually, I'm intrigued. Because it seems like a way to crack the nut that maybe we haven't approached before. So look forward to having some good discussion about it. And I'm particularly interested in hearing the airline's position, not only Delta, but for us charter airlines, and what it does to the airport fund. I want to make sure that the airport fund is kept whole.
Welcome to the committee. Whoever would like to start, state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gordon Huff. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Business Aviation Association.
Neil Bracken, I'm a board member of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association, president of the organization from 2008 and 2009. I also served on the Airport Funding Task Force in 2008 and 2009, which studied this issue, and I currently am the Director of Aviation at General Mills.
My name is John Krall. I'm also a board of director for the Minnesota Business Aircraft Association, and I'm the aviation director for Super Value.
Proceed with your testimony.
Senator Gimsey and committee members, we have worked on this issue, as Mr. Bracken indicated. We served on a task force that studied this issue for a couple of years. We had a report on how Minnesota stands in relation to our neighboring states as far as aircraft registration and fuel tax, and we find that we are one of the highest in the country on aircraft registration, one of the lowest on fuel tax. And so we've been working with our colleagues at the airlines and with our Minnesota Council of Airports and with the Minnesota Aviation Trade Association, which is the FBO's fixed base operators. They pump the fuel and do services at an airport. And we believe that we have come close to coming to an issue that, or to a solution that is revenue neutral for the state airport fund, albeit we have to say that, you know, some of the numbers we are projecting into the future, and I don't have a crystal ball that will tell you exactly what they're going to be, but we believe we've come very, very close, if not exactly on number, to keep the airport fund whole. We certainly want to have a system that is easy to administer, that is equitable, and keeps the airport adequately funded in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Hoff.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. I'll echo what was said there from Mr. Hoff, and that throughout this process, even through the Airports Funding Task Force, our goal has always been to keep that funding model whole, to keep the Department of Aeronautics fully funded. That is good for the state, it's good for the businesses in the state, and for those that operate aircraft in the state of Minnesota. I do want to say that it is extremely important for these companies that are operating aircraft. It's not just the large companies you might think of here in the metro area, but it's about small, medium, and large companies throughout the state of Minnesota. We're talking about Hormel in Austin, Schwann's down in Marshall. These companies, Fagen and Granite Falls, that operate business aircraft to furtherance of their businesses. It's about these businesses remaining competitive in a changing business. We're still operating with legislation here that was originally drafted in 1946, and businesses have changed significantly since then, and these companies need to remain competitive in small, medium, and large communities across the country and increasingly around the world. These are the kind of companies that we want to keep here in Minnesota. I can share with you just some quick numbers from a 2009 NBA study by the Nexa organization, an independent study. Among 2009's Business Week 50 most innovative companies, 95% operate business aircraft. Among the 2009 50 world's most admired companies, 95% operate business aircraft. And finally, the 100 best corporate citizens in the United States, 90% of those companies operate business aircraft. So these are progressive companies. We have a 1946 law here that we're looking to bring that stays keeps the funding model whole for the state airports fund, but also really encourages these businesses to continue growing and remain competitive across the world.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bracken?
My name is John Krall again, and the in the process of reviewing this bill, it's been always the challenge to come up with what is equitable. And, of course, depending on where you're sitting, you hear the comments, well, as long as we don't pay more and you pay less, I guess it's okay. Well, in the process of looking at a bill that was made in 1945, Super Value bought its first aircraft, business aircraft, in 1954, a twin Bonanza that cost roughly $65,000, where the registration fee is $650. When we replaced our latest aircraft, we had to make the decision where we're going to locate the aircraft. And in 2007, the aircraft was located in Minneapolis with a registration fee of $180,000. If we were to locate that aircraft in a sister company in Boise, Idaho, the registration is $300. The system needs to be addressed, and we're not trying to go from the highest to the lowest. We still will be, under this proposal, even higher than most states in the United States for aircraft registration. But we do think that the fuel tax increase is a more equitable way to access and to charge a fee for the users of the system that come and use our great system of airports in Minnesota. And we do hope that you'll consider this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Kroll. We also have Chris Roy with MnDOT here to testify on it. Roy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for your time as well, committee and chairman. My name is Chris Roy. I'm the director of aeronautics for the state of Minnesota Department of Transportation. I think what I'd like to convey is a couple of things. In principle, we've been working with the other stakeholders in this for some time. It's been a conversation that's been discussed many times. It's been around for a long time, and in principle, we've been along with them. Getting the details of this particular bill were rather late coming, so we worked on our numbers, and we've got them refined, but not all of them. And so it's a little difficult for me to say with a lot of certainty as to what this does to the airport's fund. Based on the information I have right now, it does not necessarily balance it in its entirety. We feel that there is some differences there, but what's missing is a component that would be contained within the fiscal note. And knowing that, then I would be able to testify a little bit better as to what it does to the airport fund. And I think that's of greatest concern to the state of Minnesota and MnDOT is what would that balance be in the airport fund? Because that balance is directly related to the service and the quality of airports that we have inside of our state.
Do I understand, and maybe this was early on in the discussion of this bill, but do I understand that in the event that the gas tax isn't enough to offset the registration, that there is a link to the property tax portion of the aviation, and that some of the partners or the partners are willing to step up and make up that little bit of difference in the meantime while we get this to balance out? Had I heard that in this discussion?
Chair, my understanding of that would be that is true to some degree. Generally, what happens, the three sources of revenue that Senator Lilly spoke about is exactly right. The third component is this air flight property tax, and that's a tax paid by airliners primarily. That is to be adjusted to accommodate the other revenues that actually come in. So there is an adjustment in the current system. Under this proposed bill, there is a cap for 2 years as to how much that could grow by, and that would grow over this year's amount by no more than $200,000. So there is some accommodations for that, but it is not limitless.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Reiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have or are we going to have a fiscal note on this? And then with the change in taxation, would this send our bill to taxes for a discussion?
It does send it to taxes for a discussion, and that will be tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Fiscal note. We've submitted for a fiscal note to go along with it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ryan, that's correct. We've actually requested a revenue estimate from the Department of Revenue rather than a fiscal note from MMB.
Okay.
It's my understanding that revenue estimate should be done today. And regardless of the outcome, the taxes portion of this language will bring the bill into taxes committee.
Sure. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Lilly has moved the A16 amendment.
Sorry,
Senator Reiner?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't realize we were moving to a vote. Do we have someone from the airlines?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Reiners.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines, representing Delta Airlines. And to the question Senator Reinhart raised, this has been a work in progress. We've gone through many iterations to try to hit that sweet spot. Delta's essential position has been that we're fine with reducing registration fees as long as the backstop isn't Delta Airlines. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the cap for the property aviation property tax is in for 2 years in order to at least hold Delta relatively harmless. I think we would absorb $100,000 to $150,000 increase in the property tax. But we've been supportive of finding the sweet spot. We apologize that I think this compromise is taking a little longer to flesh out. But hopefully by tomorrow morning we'll have it resolved in a revenue estimate, and then we'll know exactly what the numbers are going to be. But long story short, Delta is supportive of a solution that essentially holds Delta Airlines harmless.
Senator Reiner?
Follow up then, Mr. Chairman. So if Delta is held harmless, what about the various charter carriers? I mean, if the rollover is not to Delta, who does it roll over to? I mean, someone's going to chip in here to try and equalize this formula. I guess I find this discussion really difficult to have without a revenue note.
Ms. Ryan?
And Chairman, to that question, Senator, we have had some consultations with the other airlines. Everyone, all the airlines, commercial airlines, would be held harmless under the Lilly proposal. And so the question becomes, what if any shortfall would exist in the airport fund? I know that the department is working feverishly to try to resolve that and reach a number. But we think it's a relatively de minimis amount, but Chris is the final arbiter of that. Hopefully by the time it gets in tax committee tomorrow morning, we'll have that resolved.
And excuse me, Senator, if I may follow up on that in regards to the business aviation portion of this. Our section contributions here are going to move our taxation on fuel would double under this proposal. Even though the registration fee just to park the airplane is going to go down significantly, our fuel tax would double. And projecting on where that would fit in the budget, I know it depends on where you go back to get your projections going forward. If you use just last year, it's an anomaly if you look back in the previous 20 years, and I think you probably see that in a lot of the budget discussions that are going on. If you go back 6 years, we're actually very conservative on the numbers that we're using projecting here, which does have a bit of a shortfall, as Mr. Roy alluded to. But going back 6 years, going back 10 years, we actually level that out, and we do find that we do have a fully funded airports fund.
Senator Scher?
I don't know if anyone at the table can answer this question, but when you're shifting the revenue stream to the gasoline tax and raising that from 5 to 10 cents, in the fiscal analysis, has it been calculated in what might happen in terms of where people purchase their fuel and what the cost of fuel is in other areas of other states?
Mr. Hoff?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, right now Minnesota is one of the lowest in the surrounding area, and if going to 10 cents, we will become the highest, but only by, I think North Dakota is at 8 cents a gallon, and I think South Dakota is at 4 cents. And typically, and I think it would be better if Mr. Bracken addressed this, where you buy your fuel to tanker it, as they call it, where you fill up and then don't buy it at another airport, becomes very expensive to carry that fuel to altitude and burn more while you're flying to your destination. And for 2-3 cents a gallon, aircraft of business aircraft are not going to make that decision to fly even 15-20 minutes. When you land the airplane, it's a cycle, so there's wear and tear on your brakes and your landing gear, and then you have to do your maintenance on that. And so when you take in all the considerations, the fuel, the 10-cent fuel is not going to force someone to land over in River Falls, Wisconsin, fuel up, and then fly to St. Paul to do business.
Yeah, the operation of our aircraft and by our member companies in the MBA is about speed to business, speed to reacts. It's access to these communities, and they're not making decisions based on 5 cents a gallon. But we do make decisions, do hear from our group. They are making decisions, as Mr. Crawl alluded to, $100,000 to park it here or work it with your sister company over here and park it for $200 per year. If you take an airplane, that's going to cost you $2,000 a year to operate. That's 50 hours of operation. You know, for us, that's 25 trips to New York to do business, to grow the business. So where this fuel tax and doubling of that is not going to be a decision maker for our group, the registration fee and registration tax currently is.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Lilly has moved the A16 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Chair? Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair, I would offer the A4 amendment.
Senator Senjum has offered the A4 amendment. Senator Senjum to the amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, it's being passed out, and maybe as it's passed out, in order to bring the amendment into order and to match up with the House, there is an effective date provision which Ms. Brzozowski has orally offered to us, and perhaps she can add that at this point, and we can judge the amendment in its totality.
Ms. Berzowski.
Mr. Chair, the oral amendment to the A4 amendment would be to add an effective date of January 1, 2012, and that would apply after 1.32, after 2.2, just as to paragraph E, and after 2.18.
Senator Senjum's motion is to verbally amend the A4 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment prevails. Now we are on the A4 amendment as amended. Senator Senjum.
And thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. This is an amendment that has to do with anatomical gifts, otherwise known as perhaps organ donations. And what it involves is to establish at the time that one is seeking a Minnesota identification card and an instruction permit, a provisional license, or a driver's license, that person would have the option of a $2 donation into a fund which would then go forth and have to do with the general education of the population relative to the values of organ donation. As I think is generally well known, many organ donors are, in fact, victims of accidents. And so that's the nexus here in terms of looking this direction as a possible funding source for this important cause. And I think we all realize that, and there are people in this audience that could come to the table, Mr. Chair, and testify more, but certainly organ donation and the procurement of organs is very important, and there's never enough of these. And again, through this fund, a $2 voluntary donation to the cause of education in the area of organ donation, the hope is, of course, that more will occur. There is in Section 22 a notation here where a report would come back to the legislature February 1st, 2013, relative to the success of this effort. So that's in essence of the amendment. If there are more technical questions, I don't see the person, but I do think there's a person in this room that can help me further from the organizations that deal with this.
Senator Rest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support this amendment, but I do have some questions about it. Is there a fiscal note here in that anticipates, I don't know, maybe based on experience in other states, how much such a voluntary donation would bring in? And I wonder why, Senator St. Jim, you chose $2 as opposed to something else. And then I'm assuming, even though it's just $2, that it's also it is a charitable contribution for anybody that wanted to take a deduction for it. And then I'm trying to figure out how the money would be used, reading it really quickly. How would the money be used? And how many organizations are there that are Minnesota organ procurement organizations? Is there more than one? Are there a half a dozen? And I see that they'd be given a grant, but what would they then be doing? Would it just be education and, trying to encourage people to become owner organ donors? Tripped on that.
Senator Sandrum?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, there were a lot of questions there. I was trying to write them down, but
I'm sorry.
and we'll try to get to them. I think, and I don't have a personally, there was a fiscal note that I did see. That fiscal note says it would take $3,000 to reprogram the computer, and that money would come out of the contribution, that initial $3,000. After that, it didn't appear that there were any tangible costs of significance anyway. In other words, they were going to be accepted within the framework of the collecting agency. So that's the fiscal note is $3,000.
Okay.
And if I'm wrong, tell me, please. Okay. If I'm wrong, she will tell us. And she says it's correct. So with that, though, you had a number of other questions, and we do have a witness at the table, Mr. Chair, and maybe this person can talk a little bit more about the process and the organizations and so on.
Welcome to the committee. If you,
would
identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Susan Mao Larson, and I am with LifeSource. And Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. And thank you, Senator Rest, for your questions. Like Senator Senjum, I was trying to write them down, so I will try to answer them all. And if I miss, you can help me. The first question you asked is the amount of potential revenue that we can anticipate that would come through this. This bill is based on successful bills like this in other states, and their experience with revenue honestly ranges from $60,000 a year in the smaller states to about $1 million a year from Indiana. So the amount of revenue that we can anticipate is varied, and it will really depend upon the citizens of Minnesota coming forward. My guess is we can anticipate about $150,000 a year. LifeSource is a nonprofit organization, and we are the organization that is designated by CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to manage organ donation after death for the regions of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and three counties in Wisconsin. We are the only organ procurement organization that serves Minnesota and that is designated by CMS in a system that is really well established for the purposes of the fact that we would not have competition for organ donation, knowing this is a gift and that we need to do all we can to help facilitate this gift. So we are the organ procurement organization. Why $2? Again, looking at the experience of other states, we see the range in their bills go anywhere from about $1 to $5. And $2 seems like a reasonable amount of money. It's fairly nominal. It probably would not have a significant burden, and yet would be something nice that citizens, if they feel compelled to give to this cause, could do so in a very simple way. And when all of these $2 are pulled together, it would have significant amount of income that would really help us to achieve our goals. Organ and tissue donation is really a unique aspect of healthcare in that it cannot succeed. Surgeons, medical professionals, LifeSource, we cannot do what we need to do without the participation of individuals. We absolutely rely on individuals who typically when they get their driver's license are saying, you know, I would like to make a gift to help those hundreds of thousands of people who are in need of such a gift. And so we need to do all we can to reach out to those individuals, provide them information on donation, make sure they understand that, and hopefully empower them to make that personal decision. We're doing pretty well in Minnesota. More than half of our citizens have registered to donate, and we think that's really fabulous. But we know it's not enough. We know states like Colorado are higher, at least 10 to 15% higher than we are, Utah, Indiana, Alaska. And so we believe that this would provide additional resources so that we would be able to increase this, increase the number of people who are saying yes to donation. In 2010, in our three states that we serve, almost 100 people died who could have helped others through donation, and they didn't. They didn't indicate in their lifetime they wanted to donate, and their families declined the opportunity. So our goal is to try to increase the number of people who say yes to donations so that when that time comes, they can help others. And we believe hundreds of lives can be saved as a result. So that's really what this bill is about.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, the Senator Senjum moves the A4 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to offer the A7 amendment.
Senator Dibble moves the A7 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
To the amendment, Senator Dibble.
Chair, the A7 amendment, hoping we're starting off on a positive note, to kind of shape up a little momentum here. And
let's hope not too much momentum.
What this does, Mr. Chair, and we spoke about it earlier during session, this extends the a technology surcharge, driver and vehicle services on a variety of transactions that they currently have, the $1.75 to 2015 from the 2013 that you had placed in your bill. This is in response to their testimony a couple days ago, in which they made a fairly compelling case that it would be very difficult for them to proceed on the path that they're on without knowing that they'll be able to count on these dollars. And so I think there's a general sense of the chair and the committee that though the Minlar system and its rescoped ended up being a little more expensive than we thought, it still is a vital technology upgrade to the business processing services that DBS does for us.
Senator Stephen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to add my support to that and remind members what we heard from the department, that DVS can't procure any contracts without knowing that they'll have enough money to complete the work. And so it just makes sense that we ensure that there will be this money available so that they can procure those contracts and not waste the money that has already been expended.
Right. The way I understand Senator Stephen is that they could procure the contracts, but it would be substantially more expensive if they went the route of not having assurances that they have the money. And like Senator Dibble said, he and I talked earlier, and we both had this amendment to go back with respect to Ms. McCormick and her testimony the other day. We think it's vitally important that the Minlar system go forward and get completed. So, yeah, very good.
So, Mr. Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to have a bipartisan touch on this bill. But no
getting off to the right foot, Senator
no guarantees
Dibble.
Of future votes.
does that guarantee
we'll
passage?
I'm sure the bill will pass.
Senator Dibble, I would, I know that we don't usually talk about what the other body is doing, but this was one of the few things that actually made it through the in the bill on the other side over there. So it's a good deal. So.
And Mr. Chair, the other body was definitely persuaded through the process because they started out nowhere on this. So
exactly. Well, I am mistaken, Senator Dibble. It wasn't this provision. It didn't make it through. So I'm glad that we're going to have this position. It did not. I'm glad that we're going to have this position as our Senate position too. So Senator Dibble moves the A7 amendment. Any further discussion?
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Whether to take up a controversial one or not, we just have a few minutes probably here. But
unanimous?
And bipartisan. What our plan is to recess to the call of the chair. Energy will be coming in here at 3 o'clock, and hopefully their meeting will be shorter, and we'll be able to readjourn at about 4:30, maybe even a little earlier than that. We'll work through the rest of the amendments to this bill and pass it out of committee yet this evening. So let's recess to the call of the chair, hopefully about 4:30.
So, Mr. Chairman, are you going to call us?
We will email and call and find a way to get a hold of members as soon as we have a good indication of when we'll reconvene.